And, of course, we're going to take phone calls. Douglas Preston with us. We're talking about his work with artificial intelligence and some of his writings, his books. We'll get to your calls in a minute on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Douglas Preston with us. Douglas, you also had The Relic turned into a movie, didn't you?
Yes, we did. That was a book I wrote with Lincoln Child. We write a series of novels featuring a character, an FBI agent known as Pendergast.
That was a great box office hit.
It was. It was a number one box office hit, and it was, you know, it was a pretty good movie, I have to say. Although I have a funny story about that. When the movie first came out, my agent pointed to a clause in my movie contract that said that if I criticized the movie, I could be liable for damages up to the cost of making the film, which was $50 million. So,
a great movie.
It was a great movie.
I don't blame you. So what are you working on next? What's next for you?
Well, Lincoln and I have this series that features Pendergast, and we have a novel coming out called Blue Labyrinth, which is it's a standalone novel in the Pendergast series, and Well, it's a very complicated novel. It starts off with Pendergast opening the door to find one of his most hated enemies delivered dead to his doorstep as kind of a gift. And it starts, and you know, that they autopsy the body. They find a piece of turquoise in the stomach, and they realize it came from a mine in California near the Salton Sea. Near, you know, if you're familiar with the Salton Sea, it's a very strange, eerie place with deserted resorts that were built in the 50s and 60s on the shores of this sea, which then retreated and the resorts went bankrupt. So that's the setting for the first part of the novel, and it goes on from there.
That's exciting. Good for you. Okay, let's take some phone calls, too, while we've got you. Let's go to Savant in Kansas City, Missouri, to get things started. Hello there.
Hey, George. Hi, guys. It's been a while since I've been able to talk to you. I've got a couple of real quick ones here. First of all, I noticed that there was mention of a book written about taking a trip to Titan, the moon of Jupiter, when actually Titan is the moon of Saturn. My main question was, you'd had a conversation in depth about artificial intelligence, but I never heard any mention of Ray Kurzweil and the contracts that the government has been giving Google for Terminator-type robots and for drones. And you had also mentioned some high-speed frequency trading and how much money was being basically ripped off of traders, and there was one program that you didn't mention, even going through all those names, one of which is called LIBOR. It's LIBOR, that a trader called the Whale actually lost over $700 trillion.
Where did he have that kind of money to lose?
It was all in derivative trading they actually ended up ripping off China and Europe and Britain and all these other countries that, you know, in the global aspect of derivative trading, that's one reason why China has the capability to now come in and want to start buying up our national parks and whatever, because we owe them so much money.
Well, I don't know about that program called LIBOR, did you say?
LIBOR, yeah, just like
the London Interbank,
the interbank
rate. Yeah, that I'm not familiar with that program, but there was a lot of manipulation that went on of the LIBOR interest rate index, which came to light. But the manipulation went on for years and years, and a lot of that manipulation did in fact occur through computerized program trading strategies and unfair and devious trading strategies that basically artificially changed or moved the LIBOR rate or misreported the LIBOR rate to the central banks for, you know, various for nefarious gain. So I think that's what you might be talking about. And yes, Titan is a moon of Saturn.
Yeah.
I don't know where If I said Jupiter, that was.
I didn't hear you say Jupiter. Maybe you did, but in your work, you've said Saturn. So
yes,
you're right. So Tom Sizemore played your star in The Relic, huh?
He did. Yeah, he certainly did.
He's a good actor. He's had his problems, but he's a good actor.
Yeah, he is. And in fact, I just saw Natural Born Killers the other day, and I was really impressed. That guy has a lot of talent. Also in Relic, Linda Hunt played the museum director. She was terrific. And Penelope Ann Miller played the scientist, the sort of the main scientist. And it was a fun movie. It was very strange. I got to tell you, I remember writing Relic, and it takes place in the Museum of Natural History in New York, where I used to work.
It's a thriller, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I worked in the museum for about 8 years, and it's a wonderful place. But it does have its sort of bureaucratic and administrative problems and difficult people. And so after I left the museum, when I wrote Relic, I thought, oh, this is great. I'm just going to kill all these people off. It was a job fantasy come true, but in a legal way.
That's right. With a swipe of a typewriter.
Right. And instead of going postal, I just went pencil and wrote them all out. So it was funny, when Paramount Pictures bought the rights to the book, they wanted to film in the museum in New York City. And they sent their president, or the president went to the museum and asked the president of the museum if they could film there, and offered them $1 million fee plus expenses.
Wow.
And the president of the museum went on a tirade and said, that's absolutely out of the question. I've read that book, Relic. That is a terrible book. That is a horrifying book. That book has no redeeming social value. What makes you think we would ever allow a book like that to be filmed in our museum? And basically threw him out of the office.
Did not take the $1 million.
No. Well, when he mentioned the $1 million, he said something like, we have an endowment of $500 million. We don't need your money. So Paramount went to the Field Museum in Chicago, and they were much more receptive.
Oh, yeah, they probably loved that check.
Oh, they did. And that's a great museum. That is really one of the great museums. So they had to rewrite the script a little bit to figure out how to – there's a ship, a derelict ship that's discovered in New York Harbor, and that's where the novel begins. And they had to figure out how to get that derelict ship into Lake Michigan. But they did a good job, and I thought it was a well-done movie.
We go to Craig now in Sarasota, Florida, east of the Rockies. Craig, good morning. Go ahead.
Hey, George Douglas. How are you guys tonight?
Great. All is well.
Very well, thanks.
Fantastic. Well, my Uncle Jack, who passed away, he always listened to your radio show. I'll get to the point. I'm actually studying biochemical engineering at USF here in Florida. And we were talking about AI intelligence. Now, do you think with the computerized structural curvature of the kids these days, I mean, talking about their brain, the usage of computers and internet, Facebook, rather than having books, do you think the dexterity of, their even turning the pages is going to have I'll be back.
They might be.
Well, I'm sure that their dexterity in hand-eye coordination and that sort of thing is increased. And in fact, they found that playing computer games is in fact good training if you want to be a fighter pilot. It really helps. So, I don't think it's entirely bad that kids are playing computer games and doing all that stuff. And I think it certainly may add to their ability to cope and get by in our contemporary world, our computerized world. I just wonder what it's going to be like when a kid who never went outdoors and never ran through the woods and played wiffle ball, with a bunch of other kids in a sandlot somewhere with no rules and no umps and no parents there. I just wonder how that's going to change the arc of their lives. So I just don't know. I mean, we're facing an unknown world. I mean, my kids, I've got an 18 and a 20-year-old, and they kind of grew up with computers, although mm-hmm. not from the very beginning, but beginning enough, and they seem okay to me, so I got my fingers crossed.
Times are changing, though, aren't they?
Yeah.
They really are. What do you see as some of the ethical issues with AI?
Well, you know, I was in reading about AI, I came across a book on, a chapter in a book on the ethical and, you know, should we, for a true AI program, should we consider extending ethical and moral obligations to that program? For example, the program begs and pleads not to be turned off or not to be erased. You know, do you have any kind of ethical obligation to listen to that, or can you just erase the program guilt-free? You know, when I first read that, I thought that was a pretty ridiculous question. But it turns out a lot of very
serious... The more you thought about it.
Yeah, the more I thought about it, the more I said, look, you can't... If you can't tell the program from a human being, if every reaction it has is human, now that can be really a confusing and difficult thing to decide you're just going to turn that program off. I mean, for example, in my novel, I was thinking about, well, what would an AI program really think about being copied? I mean, I certainly don't want to have copies of myself running around that I don't control, and most normal people, I think, wouldn't. There may be some people out there who want to see 100 clones of themselves, but it might be very reasonable for an AI program to object to being copied.
What do you think of Asimov, by the way, and his three laws of being a robot?
Yeah, the three laws of robotics. The one that I shall never hurt a human being.
Yeah, 2000. Hal already went past that one.
Well, the thing is, it's a bit of a contradiction there, because If you create a truly autonomous computer program and create a situation where it does have to have the option of not obeying or overriding commands from its creator or from a human, you could very well have the program deciding that the best thing to do is to kill this person. But we talked about that earlier,
mm-hmm.
to kill one person instead of three people.
One to save three.
Yes, exactly.
Let me read the laws for people who don't know what they are. Number one, a robot may not injure a human being or, through an action, allow a human being to come to harm. Number two, a robot must obey orders given it by human beings, except where such orders would conflict with the first law. And number three, a robot must protect its own existence as long as such protection does not conflict with the first or second law. So that means the robot can't survive if the human is going to die in the process, right?
That's right, yeah. Those are good laws, but do you think the Chinese or the North Koreans building robots are going to build them according to those laws?
No.
I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
I mean, it's very nice. That's a perfect world, and I'm a huge fan of Isaac Asimov. But... you know, the weaponization of AI right there is a violation of those laws. You know, you put a little AI program into a bumblebee and you send it in to Kim Jong-un's palace, and the bumblebee takes care of him. There's a violation of...
How realistic do you see that as happening one day?
Well, I see it as inevitable one day. The real question is, how soon is it going to happen?
So let's say that Kim is giving a speech and they've got some kind of military parade, and all of a sudden you send a swarm of these little drone flies on them, you know, all lethal. They'll just attack, they bite him, and that's it for him.
Yeah. And then...
And you can't stop that. How do you stop that?
Well, that's the thing. How do you stop it? How do you even know it's happening? I mean, certainly there'll be countermeasures of some kind, fairly sophisticated, I'm sure. But what are we going to do? Keep our windows shut all day? Are we not going to walk out in the park? I mean, is the president going to have to be kept in a sealed pod during the time he's president?
God, that is sci-fi at its maximum, isn't it?
It is, and yet it's not that far away. Honestly, at the they're building these little miniature drones already. They haven't overcome all the technical problems, but they will, and I think they will fairly soon. I think we could be looking at this in 10 to 20 years or less.
Next up, we go to Tara in Charleston, South Carolina. Hello, Tara, go ahead.
Hey, I have so many questions. I'm such a huge fan of yours. I wanted to know two things. One, really briefly, how on earth do you and Lincoln Child write together? Is one guy the writer and the other guy's the idea guy? And I wanted to find out, too, I'm dying to know about the murder on your Italian property that you tried to solve. Did you ever solve it? And I read all your work on Amanda Knox and how you just debunked the whole case against her and your whole, you know, soap opera in Italy with the prosecutor. Did that reporter ever solve that crime? I guess those are my two questions. I could ask you 15.
Good.
Go ahead.
Well, they're great questions. Well, I'll start with the first one. You know, Lincoln Child and I have written probably 25 books together, maybe.
Wow.
And I think, you know, 13 or 14 were bestsellers. We have a good system of operating. It works like this. We brainstorm together. We come up with a plot. We do the first 10 chapters in a sort of a chapter outline, or maybe 20 chapters. And then we each take a sequence of chapters to write. So I'll write a sequence from Pendergast's point of view, and he might write a sequence from another character's point of view. And then we swap the chapters, and then Lincoln rewrites my work, which really pisses me off. And I rewrite his work, which makes him angry. But through all the strife, we have create a pretty tight writing style. We don't let each other get away with anything. And I think the books, as a result, are fairly tightly written. At least I hope they are. And we've got a great, you know, we trust each other. If Lincoln tells me something stinks, after I've thoroughly cursed him out, I have to believe him, because that's why he's my partner. We live 2,000 miles apart, and it's a funny thing. Whenever we get together to work, it never works. We sit around, and Lincoln brings out a mossy bottle of single malt whiskey, and we have a little taste, and then we start telling each other what fine fellows we are, and no work gets done. We start complaining about our, you know, publisher or whatever. So we do our best work when we're 2,000 miles apart. So, and then the question about, was the case ever solved? The case was never, of the Monster of Florence, was never solved. It's still open. And the Italian police are still off on a wild goose chase looking for a satanic sect behind the killings.
So we have our suspicions, right, at this point.
That's right. Well, Mario and I interviewed the fellow that we think is the monster, and honestly...
Is he an Italian?
He's an Italian. He's Sardinian. That Sardinia is a part of Italy, but it's Sardinians don't really consider themselves part of Italy.
Right,
it's a little island. It's an island with a separate language and a very, very ancient and vengeful culture.
We're going to come back, Douglas, and take some final phone calls with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, Glynis McCants, the numbers lady, joins us for a couple hours, making some predictions and talking to you. And when we come back in a moment with Douglas Preston, we'll wrap things up with final calls on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, Douglas Preston with us. Douglas, of all your works, how about your favorite?
Well, I think my favorite would have to be The Cabinet of Curiosities. It's a novel, another Pendergast novel that I wrote with Lincoln. It starts off with the construction of a high-rise apartment building in New York City. They've dug down into down on the Lower East Side of New York.
Yeah.
They've dug down and broken into an old basement area. And there they discover the 36 remains of murdered women back in the 19th century. And they realize that a serial killer was operating in the 19th century, killed these women, and was never caught. In fact, they didn't even know that the crimes had been committed because these were workhouse, young workhouse girls who came from workhouses, and no one missed them when they disappeared. That's the opening of the novel.
You become an expert in serial killers, huh?
Well, I'm a collector of dark stories. I don't know, I've always been fascinated by human evil and what, you know, what it is.
What makes it tick.
Yeah, and it's there's something ineffable about evil. You can't quite wrap your mind around it.
You must know the Ted Bundy case well.
I do know that one. And, you know, it's interesting. He was a fairly, you know, he was a charming, good-looking guy.
Yes, it just reminded me of this Italian when you were telling me about him.
Yeah, and I don't know why I had the kind of probably cliched view of a serial killer as being creepy, because actually most serial killers are not creepy. They're very persuasive. They're charming. They're pure psychopaths. And a psychopath is not obviously crazy, because he's a genius at covering up his lack of empathy.
Well, then you get those whack jobs like John Wayne Gacy and Jeffrey Dahmer.
That's true. You do get the other side of the coin, too, with those serial killers.
And how about that guy from, Wichita?
Is that the BTK?
Yeah.
Yeah, that killer, I saw an interview with him where he described what he did in the most sort of factual, dry, bureaucratic terms. And I have to tell you, it was the most frightening interview I have ever seen.
Really? Just because he was just so deliberate?
It was as if he was describing, it was as if he was an accountant.
Yeah, just cold and deliberate.
A report to his client. It was so dry, and he's talking about not just murdering people, but he's talking about murdering children. It was unbelievable.
Right under the eyes of his family. Right under it.
Yes, and he...
They didn't see it.
He shared some characteristics with the Monster of Florence. One of the things these serial killers really get off on is the public attention, and they like teasing the police. The monster used to mail to the police body parts, to tease them, to mock them. And the BTK killer, he killed for a while, and then he stopped, and then people started to forget about him, and he couldn't stand that. He had to get back in the game, and he wrote a letter, and he tried to stir things up again, and that's how he got caught.
Do they want to get caught? We keep hearing that. They want to be stopped.
The FBI report said, yes, that there is a subconscious desire to be caught. But what they really most want is to control. The idea of control, they want to control their victims in the most extreme way possible, by taking away their life. They want to control the police. They want to control the media. But then underneath it all, they want to be caught. They want to be controlled themselves. Very, very, very disturbing to read about these people. But again, I think that it says something about human nature, and I think people are basically good, but I think that there's a kernel of badness in everybody, and you have to recognize that and face it. Otherwise, it could really cause a problem.
At any given time, what does the FBI say, Douglas, in terms of the amount of serial killers that are out there? 20, 50?
Serial killers are very rare. That's a very rare, this is one of the things, I recently wrote a book co-authored with John Douglas, who you may know. He's a guy you should have on your show, or Mark Olshacker. John Douglas is the pioneer of FBI psychological profiling, and he was the model for one of the characters in The Silence of the Lambs, the FBI guy. But, he's written a number of books about serial killers, their motivations, why they do what they do. He's interviewed them. He's asked them, why did you do it? Most people don't ask serial killers that question because they're so crazy. You don't want to know why they did it. You think they're crazy. They didn't have any reason for doing it. But he found that most serial killers actually explain why they did what they did. And those explanations, as sick and horrifying as they are useful for law enforcement, because serial killers fall in groups. there are certain types of serial killers, and the FBI is a database of these serial killers.
Well, wasn't the Silence of the Lambs based on a serial killer who fed them information about the other serial killer?
Yes, and it was also based on a serial killer. The Hannibal Lecter was based on a real person, and also Jane Gumm, the serial killer who's making a coat for himself, was based on an actual person who... killed.
That was Gein, wasn't it? Ed Gein?
Exactly, yes. Yeah. Yes. Yep.
God, they're all strange.
Yeah, he dug up corpses to get their skins as well.
Yeah.
I mean, it was, you know. And the FBI report on the Monster of Florence said, maybe this is a little too strong for the radio, but...
Be careful, temper it.
Well, that often this type of serial killer will consume the body parts, will become cannibalistic as a way of completely possessing.
Well, that's what Dahmer did, right?
Yes, exactly.
All right, let's go to the phones. Jim is in Charleston, West Virginia, first-time caller. Hi, Jim, go ahead.
Yes, this is a literary question for you, Douglas. First of all, you and Lincoln are two of my favorite authors. First of all, did you, in your research on your AI, did you ever read the Colossus trilogy, Colossus the Forbidden Project, Colossus and the Crab, and I can't remember the third one.
Yes, I did, as a matter of fact. I read that quite some time ago, and I think that might have been the first treatment of AI in literature that I know of. Maybe you know better than I do, but that's... And then they made an excellent movie about it as well.
Right. My second...
You with us? Oh, we lost him. When he was going to have his second question.
The AI bot strikes.
Yeah. You never know. Jerry's in Williamsport, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jerry, welcome to the show.
How you doing?
Good, Jerry. Thanks.
I was just wondering if they were going to make any more Agent Pendergast movies, if there's any plans on doing that.
Well, the Paramount Pictures owns the movie rights to the Pendergast character, and so only they can make a movie. So write Pendergast, start a free Pendergast petition.
Do you have to write the book before they do the movie?
Well, we've got a lot of Pendergast books out there, but when they bought the rights to the Relic, they acquired the rights to the characters as well. So any future book we write with Pendergast in it, we can't sell to Hollywood unless Paramount Pictures wants to buy it. So we're kind of stuck. The only customer we have is Paramount, and they're not interested so far. But
let's go to John in Wenatchee, Washington, west of the Rockies. Good morning, John.
Hey. Good. How you doing?
Okay.
Great. Hey, I was curious if you ever heard of the artificial intelligence software called Dr. Sabatso.
No, I haven't heard of it. Tell me about it.
Well, I found it back in the early 90s, maybe before Windows. I was pretty much DOS-based on a computer. Got a Sound Blaster card for my computer. Installed the drivers for it off of a 3.5-inch floppy drive. And just out of curiosity, looking at the floppy drive, did a directory listing, saw something called DRSABTC. How's that? Dr. Sabatso, DRSABOTSO. And as an executable, so I ran it. And a voice came on and said, "How may I help you? This is Dr. Sabatso."
Was it another psychoanalysis program, or?
Yes. Yep. Just a psychiatrist, and you could ask it questions by typing in, and it would answer you with a voice, and it would ask you questions.
Well, that's interesting. It sounds like a more sophisticated version of Eliza. So, very interesting.
It's AP. But it was on a 3.5-inch floppy, which is 1.44 megabytes, back in the early 90s. So, pretty fascinating.
Interesting, yeah. Yeah, those are fun programs.
What else do they come up with, Douglas? I mean, it defies logic how much they can do, but what's on the horizon?
Well, I think we're going to see a lot more programs like Siri, but much more sophisticated. And again, you know, that movie that I mentioned earlier, Her, where the house is sort of an operating system and the guy can control everything, you know, with an earbud or whatever. You know, that sort of thing is going to become pretty common, where all our devices in our home will become smart devices. And right now, it's very complicated to try to set that up and use it so people don't do it. But it's just like the computers are getting easier to use the more sophisticated they become. And the same is going to happen with all the appliances in our house. They're going to become a lot easier to use the more powerful the software becomes. AI is really a way of making software easy to use, because the more like a human being and the more like a human being you can communicate with that software, the easier it is.
Let's go to Oceanside, California now. Hello, Colleen. It's your turn.
Hi, George. Thanks for taking my call. Sure. I really love the bumper music, and I saw that interview as well with the BTO or BTH.
It was cold, wasn't it?
It was so creepy because he was very matter-of-fact when he explained everything. But that's not what I called about, although it made me think about something else. I was thinking about the kind of espionage that would go on with AI, people hacking the system. You could have other countries or even some kids sitting in a basement somewhere. And when you think about groups like Al-Qaeda or other countries or rogue people that would be able to use this kind of thing against us, weaponizing it, it makes fearfulness of nuclear technology, really it just sidelines all of that, because this can come out of anywhere. And if you apply the serial killer aspect to it, which I got to thinking about, you know, you could have somebody that just could, exploit that kind of technology and use it, against all kinds of people. And it doesn't have to be some kind of strange weapon. It can be somebody that they know that has a peanut allergy, or somebody that has, something that could go about killing people without ever even being able to trace it back to them. So when you think about the serial killers of the future with all this new technology, they might not have to make direct contact with people in order to, commit those kinds of crimes.
You should be a novelist. That's a great idea for a novel. Seriously.
I actually am working on something completely different right now, in a whole different vein, that has to do with more social, political type things. But really, when you think about applying this, this would just take it to a whole new level, and not really that unrealistic.
No, it isn't. And, the more you think about it, the more frightening it becomes, because these little drone sects or, miniature drones, bots, or whatever, coming into your house, there's a sense, collecting information on you, the way it's already being done now for our use, our computer use, but you feel like you're, not only is your privacy disappearing, but also your personal safety is gone. And for sure, these techniques could be used by terrorists to really horrific effect. And how do you protect your military leaders, the leaders of your country, from someone armed with a hat box full of mosquitoes that are deadly? Can recognize a target, seek it out, and kill it.
It's truly remarkable what's happening and how fast it's happening. What's driving the speed?
Well, it's several things. The miniaturization of computer hardware continues apace. And the other aspect of this is that programming is not keeping up with hardware. The hardware we have is far more powerful than the programming we have. In other words, the Mac on my desk here, in the hands of a really sophisticated, programmer, could be a lot more powerful and a lot more like an AI program. It might be able to run AI on existing hardware, is what I'm trying to say. It's very difficult to program AI. That's the problem with it. But, there are a lot of smart people out there, and AI is not necessarily dependent on big, massive computers. It could exist on very small machines or even little chips.
All right, let's go next to Chuck in Fredericksburg, Virginia. Let's get you in here, Chuck. Go ahead.
Hello, George and Douglas.
Hi.
I want to congratulate you on that. An hour ago when you had that back and forth about the monster of Florence,
mm-hmm.
That was the most fascinating stuff that I've heard in a long time. It was just wonderful, George, the way you led him through that.
Well,
I think that it probably was a better result than if you had just asked him to tell the whole story, because he responded so well to your questions. It was really terrific.
He's pretty good, isn't he?
Well, George is great.
You are really good.
George is one of the great radio interviewers of all time.
Yes, he is. I've been listening now to Coast for a few months, and since it's now 5 o'clock in the morning here, it's very inconvenient, but I sometimes download also.
Yeah, you download it, you'll get it. But we only have about a minute left. Chuck, do you have a quick question?
No, I don't. I just
okay.
wanted to congratulate you and thank you for that segment.
All right,
well, thank
friend.
You.
You're very, very welcome. Douglas, almost out of time. We do have to keep in touch. You need to be my expert on serial killers whenever we do those shows. And love to get John Douglas on if you want to set that up.
Oh, I'll email him and ask if he wants to do it. His writing partner, Mark Olshacker, is also terrific. He's an Emmy Award-winning filmmaker as well as a best-selling author. And those guys usually write books together. So they have a lot to say. It's pretty chilling.
Yeah, well, good luck with everything you do. If you get to Los Angeles for the debut of The Monster of Florence when it's ready, let me know. We'll all get together.
All right. Well, we'll all go to the Oscars together when it's up for the prize.
With Clooney there, he could win it. You know that.
True.
He's pretty good.
Well, his father was a journalist. That's why one of the reasons why he's interested in the story.
Super. Okay, Doug, you take care.
All right, George. Thank you.
Douglas Preston, my marvelous interviewer. Great writer, by the way. His works have been very critically acclaimed. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, George Knapp, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.